history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They're not looking for attention. They're not asking for anything, but they are certainly deserving of our gratitude. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we are educated, we're entertained, and we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In the weeks ahead, we're going to hear from a California pilot who had to fly the hump over the Himalayas to China. We're going to hear from a concrete finisher in a tiny town in New Mexico who was a cook in World War II, but ended up flying bombing missions as a replacement gunner. Today, though, we're going to focus on honor flight, something you've heard me talk about a time or two, but a cause that is so connected to the aim of this program. It's an effort that's ongoing wherever you're listening today. In fact, if you're hearing us on our newest Hometown Heroes affiliate, WRFH in Hillsdale, Michigan, Talons Out Honor Flight has a group of World War II vets in Washington, D.C. this very weekend. So does Honor Flight Kern County in California. In fact, if you're listening on our affiliate there, KNZR, you can welcome veterans home Monday night at 8:30 at the Bakersfield Airport. That's Monday, April 25th, 8:30 p.m. If you're hearing us in Albuquerque, Northern New Mexico Honor Flight is taking off again on June 1st. Just a few examples of what I mean when I say this is happening wherever you're hearing the show today. And instead of listening to just one veteran story today, we're going to hear from three different men who will finally get to see their memorial next week. You see, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. wasn't completed until 2004, but it is a special, special place. And the idea behind Honor Flight is to make sure every World War II vet has the opportunity to see it. Nobody can speak to that mission better than Earl Morse, the founder of the Honor Flight Network, who joined us on this program years ago when he was just building momentum, to explain how it all started.
We got our start in May of 2005 here in the Springfield, Ohio area. At the time, I was a physician assistant, having the honor and privilege of caring for America's veterans here in Springfield, Ohio. And sadly, here we were about 3, then 6, then 9 months after the World War II Memorial was dedicated. I was seeing approximately 300 World War II veterans in that clinic there, and not one of them had been out to see their memorial. And the worst part was that reality had set in. When I would ask the veterans, I said, you haven't been to see your memorial? Well, why not? And they'd always say, well, you know, the kids, they've been real busy, and Ma, she's been kind of sick, and we don't have the money. Well, I'm very fortunate in that I'm also a private pilot and a retired Air Force captain, a member of one of the largest aero clubs in the nation out here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So we started renting planes, paying for them out of pocket to have the honor and privilege of taking these incredible men and women, flying them out personally to Washington, D.C. to visit their memorials. We took to the skies in May of 2005. We took off in 6 planes. We flew 12 veterans. And then the next month, 8 planes, 16 veterans. The third month, 10 planes. We flew 20 veterans, and I was so proud of our effort. I went to my mom, who's been with me from the get-go, helping out. I said, Mom, we're flying 20 World War II veterans every month. Can you believe that? And she said, but son, we're getting 95 applications a month. So confronted with that major math problem there, we started looking at the commercial carriers like Southwest and AirTran and seeing how much it was going to cost us to buy up seats on those commercial carriers. And we started doing that. There is a wonderful gentleman down in Hendersonville, North Carolina. His name is Jeff Miller, and he saw what we were doing, and he said he'd like to start something like that out of Hendersonville. And I told him how to go about doing that. You know, you need a commercial carrier with direct nonstop service, and he said, we don't have that available, so we're thinking about chartering an aircraft. I said, how much is that going to cost? He said, oh, about $78,000, and I said, good luck with that, Jeff. You know, I said, this is how you do it. You know, this is the paperwork and the forms, and these are timelines and agendas that make it happen. These are the bus companies that we use, and this is how we feed the veterans. And lo and behold, he got the community behind him, and they actually ended up chartering 6 aircraft over the span of 2 years. So what really warms my heart, Paul, is that we thought out here in Ohio that we were the people that had the biggest heart for these World War II veterans. But I'll tell you what, I am finding out that all across this great nation of ours, there are citizens everywhere that do not take for granted the liberties and the blessings and the freedoms that we all enjoy. And they want to see those veterans that secured those liberties that we all enjoy finally get to see their memorial.
Again, that was Earl Morse, founder of the Honor Flight Network, which has continued to grow and grow. Thousands and thousands of World War II veterans have been able to see their memorial free of charge. And in many places, Korean War veterans and even Vietnam vets have been able to experience Honor Flight as well. Where I live in Central California, we started Central Valley Honor Flight in 2013. And to parallel what you heard Earl Morse say, we have seen the heart that people have for these heroes. The response has been incredible. The 9th Central Valley Honor Flight is headed out Monday morning and will return Wednesday night, April 27th. I'll be out at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport to welcome them home. So if you're in my area, I'd love to see you there Wednesday at 5:30. And if you do come, you can keep an eye out for the men we're going to hear from now, 3 of the vets who will be taking this journey of a lifetime. Let's start with Wayne Thompson of Clovis, California, who had a unique role for 30 missions in B-17s over Europe during World War II. He's 92 years old now, but the Pennsylvania native was just 18 and off studying engineering at Ohio State when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
I guess you'd have to have been there to feel it, but there was a tension and an atmosphere of what can we do for our country? And even though we didn't want to be taken out of college, I felt that it was a pretty big thing to be able to jump into the Air Force and be a potential pilot in the Air Force.
And that's the one, and people who listen to this show regularly are probably sick of hearing me say this, but every time I interview someone who was in the Air Corps, I ask that question because it seems like no matter if you ended up as a bombardier or a gunner or a navigator, you chose the Air Corps because you wanted to be a pilot, right?
Yes, yes. And you may want to talk about it later, Paul, but later on in my cadet training, it was discovered I was colorblind. So they immediately ran me out of being a pilot, and I got back in on a waiver to be a bombardier. So that's how I happened to be a bombardier. I was really disappointed that I wasn't going to. By that time, I had 10 hours of flying in a Piper Cub.
And once you get that taste of it, you don't want to let it go, right?
Yeah, I was hot to trot. I scooted around and found out that it was possible to get a waiver. And I did that, and I got accepted. And so immediately I was put back into what was called the cadet training program. The only difference was I was trained as a bombardier, not as a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we flew an AT-11s, which was a twin-engine plane for bombing and navigation, but it was not a hot pursuit.
No, and a B-17 wasn't either. This was going to be a big beast you'd end up on. But as some of our listeners know, when you're on a bombing run in a B-17, there's one person that's in control of that aircraft.
That's right.
And that was?
That was me. Uh-huh. In fact, as standard bombardier, every plane had a bombardier in the nose. But because I was a radar bombardier navigator, I flew lead, and I was actually directing 12 planes, or in some cases, 24 planes or 36 planes over a target.
Your very first mission with the 379th Bomb Group out of Kimbolton, England, targeted Mannheim, Germany on December 11th, 1944. What did that first mission teach you about what this was all going to be like?
That anti-aircraft fire really is anti-aircraft fire. And an old timer told me over there, he said, as long as you can see the black clouds, you're okay. But when you start hearing it, then you know it's getting close.
And when you feel it, it's the worst, huh?
Right.
So did you feel any flak that day?
No. I really can't tell you, Paul, what made my luck different, but I really never had close hits from flak. We had a lot of bad weather, and a couple of times I thought we were going to have collisions because of bad weather, but it's just one of those things.
Well, and you bore a heavy responsibility for that as the Navigator Bombardier on the lead aircraft.
Yes.
And I don't want to miss one important thing here, too. And we had a Bombardier on this program a while back who had a silver dollar that his wife gave him that he carried with him on every bombing mission. Your wife gave you something else that you wore every time you went up in the sky.
Yeah, she gave me a special wrist bracelet with my name on it, and I wore it every mission.
And I'm sure there are plenty of times you looked over at it and thought of her, right?
Yes.
So now explain to our listeners, if you can, the significance of being the lead aircraft and why it was you, why you had to be the bombardier on that lead aircraft on all of these missions.
Okay. You might call it, Paul, a triple layer of backup. We had a regular bombardier, we had a regular navigator, but so much of Germany was overcast in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the bombardier and the navigator couldn't see, they were useless in terms of being effective.
Right.
And that's where the radar took over. So many days I actually took squadrons or two squadrons or three squadrons, sometimes a group lead. I took them in because I could see by radar where we were going.
So you're sitting in the nose of the airplane?
No, we're sitting just back of the bomb bay. The radio op was on my left and I was on the right. The radar unit was just behind me in the fuselage area.
And I don't want to overstate it, but I'm just trying to get a picture of how big of a deal this is, and I'm sure our listeners are trying to figure it out too. A lot of these missions, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got squadron after squadron heading for the same bombing target, and they're all dependent on you in that lead plane to direct them to the target.
Yes.
Was that pressure on you?
Well, maybe part of it was being the wonders of youth. We were all scared. You got to admit that, and particularly if there's bad flak coming up and aircraft fire. But it was just a job, I think, Paul. You know, and I had the courage and the skill and the drive to make damn sure, it was okay. You know, everything was going to be okay.
And you were 21 years old.
21.
That's a lot of responsibility for a 21-year-old.
Yeah, we were glad to be back at the end of the flight. You know, sometimes it was 10 hours, 11 hours, and you were on oxygen from 12,000 feet up, and we usually went in at 25,000 or 27,000, so there was no pressurized cabin. It was cold. It was miserable.
Yeah, this is December of 44, the coldest winter that Europe had ever seen.
Yes.
And you're higher up with
yes.
no pressurized cabin. Brr, again. I'm going to read for you the text of a citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross, which Wayne received, not even knowing that he received it, and we'll get that story. But here it goes. It says, Wayne B. Thompson, 1st Lieutenant Air Corps, United States Army, for extraordinary achievement while serving as radar navigator of bombardment formations composed of B-17 aircraft on bombing missions over Germany, 2 March 1945 and 30 March 1945. Unable to bomb the primary target on 2 March 1945, Lieutenant Thompson directed the formation to a secondary objective where an instrument bomb run was initiated. Although excessive headwinds were encountered, this officer furnished computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. On 30 March 1945, the outstanding proficiency exhibited by Lieutenant Thompson was instrumental in the successful bombing of a vital enemy installation in the face of adverse weather conditions. The courage, coolness, and skill displayed by Lieutenant Thompson reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. And you didn't know about this until you were already back home?
I was back home. In fact, I was going to Purdue University, and I got announcement in the mail. And they want to know if I'd come to Washington. I said, I can't. Yeah, I'm going to school.
They wanted you to go to Washington to have a general pin it on you?
Yeah. So I said, I can't do that. So they said, all right, we'll mail it to you.
Uh-huh. Funny how things work. Now let's get back to these missions. So on March 2nd of 1945, and according to your log, the target that time was Chemnitz. And this says that you couldn't bomb the primary target, and that was because of the weather?
Yeah, and in fact, Paul, in those days, at least in my experience in those days, nobody talked about jet stream. But we actually had picked up a jet stream going in to the target. And I called the chief pilot, and I said, sir, if we continue on this plan, we're going to have a ground speed of about 80 miles an hour because of the headwind. So he said, well, we can't do it. I said, that's right. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's go to the secondary, which was a different heading.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did, and we made a good run.
But you still, no one could see the targets. It says
that's
here,
right.
An instrument bomb run.
Yeah, I used radar.
So when you're looking through that in that radar equipment, what are you seeing that tells you you found your target, it's time to drop the bombs? Because that's a pretty significant thing to drop these bombs. If you're not hitting your target, you're killing civilians.
Right. The radar had various settings. One, you could see the whole western coast of Europe. Then as you kept reducing your ranges down, you get down to like a 10-mile range.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're able to focus in on the target. And radar on targets, it was perfect if there was a river next to it where you could absolutely zero in on your target. Otherwise, you had to keep shooting fixes on other towns or radar maps to make sure you're on the right one.
The river would help you because there's no...
There's no return. It was just... You would see the perfect outline of the river. In fact, over Bremen, the submarine pens, you could actually almost see the pens with radar.
And obviously that's another place that you bombed. But so this, what it credits in this citation was the computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. So you don't have a little computer like they have these days. You don't have a calculator in your hand. You're scribbling out on a piece of paper, doing the math to figure out that you're going to the right spot?
Yeah. Actually, part of the plan of radar bombing was you would also set up the lead bombardier in the nose. I would call out fixes to him, and the Norden bombsight, he would then set it up so that if he could at the last second see it, he could take over.
Mm-hmm.
But usually he never saw it. But what I was actually doing was calling out successive ranges as we were going over the target areas.
Mm-hmm.
So in that process, we set up the bomb site so it would all be an automatic drop.
Gotcha. So that was March 2nd of 1945. And then on the 30th of March that month, the other mission that this Distinguished Flying Cross citation mentions, Bremen was your target. The U-boat pens that so many people have heard of were right along the river there, as you talked about. And in this time, it says they're giving you credit because of the adverse weather conditions that you faced. Yeah. How crazy was it?
It was pretty crazy. In fact, like the 12 planes in a squadron, it was difficult for the 12 planes to stay together. The weather was that bad. In fact, I think, as I recall in that mission, some squadrons or other groups, some of them aborted, went back because they just couldn't hack it. They couldn't stay with it.
Now, what made your mind, and obviously you're the radar navigator of the lead plane, but this is a discussion you're probably having with your pilot as well, I imagine.
Yes.
What made that decision to keep going and make sure you hit this target?
Well, it's probably a combination. You had to have a lead pilot and his crew that were willing to take the chance of bad weather, because there's always a chance in bad weather of mid-air collisions. So, you know, maybe part of it was luck, Paul. I don't know, but he elected to go through it, and I just kept calling out the checkpoints and guiding them in.
There's a little more to Wayne's story that I want you to hear. If you're a parent, I think this is really going to resonate with you. We'll get to that after the break, and also meet two other World War II vets who will get to see their memorial in the week ahead thanks to Honor Flight. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A little different show today. Instead of one veteran sharing his experiences over the course of 1 hour together, we're hearing from 3 different vets who will all be on one big charter plane with Central Valley Honor Flight this coming week. Again, the Honor Flight Network has an active hub in every area where this program is heard. If you have a World War II vet in your life who has not been to the National World War II Memorial, sign him up or sign her up. I have links for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find some photos of Wayne Thompson, who completed 30 missions with the 379th Bomb Group as a radar navigator bombardier. He'll finally get to visit the National World War II Memorial and see a wall of gold stars signifying the more than 406,000 Americans who never came home from that war.
Is that something you ever thought about? Did you think, you know what, maybe this mission is my last mission?
Towards the end, I got that way. I said, man, I hope this one's going to be another good one.
Was it because you knew you were getting close to that number where you'd be able to come home?
Yeah, I think so.
And you had a wife waiting at home.
Right.
And by this time, did you know that she was expecting?
Yes. And in fact, my number one son was born while I was over in England. And I got a telegram on March 1st, 45, saying, you're the proud father of a baby boy. So
that's a pretty big incentive to get home, isn't it?
Yes. The captain congratulated me on my 30 missions, and he said, Lieutenant Thompson, how'd you like to be a captain? Well, sir, what's that mean? What do I have to do? And he shoved a piece of paper at me and said, well, you can sign this piece of paper. I said, well, what am I signing, sir? Well, you sign permission for another tour, and I'll give you your captain bars right now. And I said, thank you, sir, but no thanks.
So it was a choice between coming home to a wife and a son you've never met or flying more missions in Europe. Tough call. So when did you get home, and what did that feel like?
It was great. My wife met me in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh was about 60 miles from Sharon, Pennsylvania. I came in by, train into Pittsburgh, and it was a great, what a meeting.
And you had you even seen a picture of your baby boy?
No, had not.
You had the telegram, you knew he was born on March 1st.
Yeah.
What was that like to see a child first time?
It was just overwhelming, Paul. It just, the emotions that time, probably, I can't remember exactly, but I know how lucky I was to get home and see my son and my wife. And, when I was at Langley Field getting ready to leave to go overseas, I met my wife at the airfield, and we said goodbye. And I said, I must be really dumb. Here you are, you're pregnant. I'm going overseas. I don't know where I'm coming back.
I know those emotions are still very strong, and you take all the time you need to get through it.
You know what? When I left her, I said, man, I'm not so sure you're so smart doing all this. but it worked out.
Something tells me she was saying a few prayers for you while you were over there.
Yeah, yes, she was.
And you got a few letters from her, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I know you missed her very much. And, Wayne, I know that that all your family is certainly thankful for what you did during the war. And on behalf of our audience, I want to thank you for serving and for being willing to share with us about it. And there's one more thing you did when you came back that's kind of an interesting twist to all this. We talked about how you wanted to be a pilot, but when they found out you were colorblind and said no more, you became a pilot after all.
Yeah. Real quickly, Paul, I found out I could get my private pilot's license. And I said, well, what about being colorblind? They said, oh, that's not a problem. They said, what we'll do, we'll take you out onto the tarmac, and the tire will shoot colored light guns at you, and they'll flash the light. I said, if you can tell red, green, and blue, and white, you're a pilot. So I did, and I got my private license.
So he does know what it's like to be in the cockpit, but he's more than happy to be a passenger on next week's Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C., and there will be plenty of other pilots on board, like 92-year-old Bob Stoneham of Mariposa, California. The son of a Spanish-American War veteran, Bob headed overseas in July of 1944, not knowing what twin-engine plane he'd be flying once he arrived in England. He found out it would be the B-26 Marauder, a plane he had never flown in training stateside, and unfortunately, he had heard some of the B-26's nicknames.
The flying prostitute, for example, mm-hmm. No visible means of support, the Widowmaker.
The Martin
heard
Murderer?
About their training in Florida, a plane a day in Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm. That can't be very encouraging. That's not the kind of reputation an aircraft wants to carry.
It was a good airplane. Don't knock it.
Well, you're here. So that's proof enough for me, but I'm just trying to, again, put myself in your shoes. And that's not what you want to hear about the plane that you're going to be flying. But I imagine you took to it fairly quickly, got accustomed to it.
Very easy, right.
What did you like about the B-26? I know it was designed to be a little faster than the B-25, for example.
It was heavy, and it felt like it would take the whatever they threw at us, and it did. We had some of the missions, we had a lot of flak. We had a lot of holes in the airplane. Had one mission where a shell went through the wing about 6 feet from me and happened to not explode, or I would not have been here today. Went on above the plane and exploded above us. But it was a good airplane to be in, solid.
Now, those are the stories that fascinate me when you talk about close calls and how easily something could have been different. So the shell passed through?
Through the wing. When it came up, we were at about 13,000 feet, and mm-hmm. it was an aircraft from below. But the shell went through the wing. It didn't explode.
What did that sound like?
Well, I never heard it. Didn't even know what happened.
It was
the first I knew, I looked up, and our wingman was looking down, and his eyes were about as big as saucers, and he was pointing. And then we didn't know that it happened until we got on the ground.
So he saw the shell come through and explode above you?
He saw it go through, yes.
Wow.
The missions were assigned by the headquarters based on requests most of the time from the ground troops. Like Patton, his army would ask for certain things to be done, and we would be assigned a marshalling yard where the trains were gathered. We would be assigned to mostly railroad bridges. In fact, the nickname of our group was the Bridge Busters at one time. And that was the type of thing that we did practically all the time.
Because of the B-26 and the firepower that you carried, at least that's your understanding, you didn't see a whole lot of fighter opposition from the Germans.
No. So we had a machine gun turret on the top of the aircraft. We had a tail gun turret. And we had fixed forward machine guns. We flew in tight formation. We flew in ship flight formations of six, very, very tight. And it was obvious that anyone that was attacking us was going to have a lot of 50-caliber machine gun fire coming their way. So we, at the time I was over there, we were never attacked by enemy fighters.
Well, and I know you're not complaining about that. No. You mentioned the machine guns, and as I understand it, you didn't fire those machine guns, at least on your plane, until your last mission?
Yeah, we had four fixed forward machine guns on the side of the aircraft, and on the last mission, which was right near the end of the war, and what I called a demoralization mission, they were trying to get the Germans to forget the whole thing and give up, mm-hmm. and we went in and bombed at 5,000 feet, which was about half our normal altitude, and then made a 180 and came back and machine gunned the village. I didn't see any people. We were shooting at buildings, so I didn't have a guilty conscience over it. It was just kind of a, here we go, whoopee, we're going to fire our guns for the first time.
I imagine there was some joking about that on the aircraft.
That's right.
You didn't know if they worked or not, probably.
Probably true.
So in the B-26, 12 missions, ever any time that the landing was a little hairy or you didn't know if you were going to make it down in one piece?
B-26 landings are always hairy.
Just by the nature
of it,
by
the nature, that's right. You're coming in at about 130, 120 miles an hour, and they were always hairy.
Jiggle your brain a little bit,
That's right.
Bridge busters and brain busters. But I understand your scariest situation as far as landing a plane, and maybe the one that you look back, besides the shell going through your wing and say, wow, that could have ended up a lot different for me. You weren't even in a B-26, but an aircraft that was a little smaller with a little less firepower. Tell me about that.
Yeah, while we were stationed near Paris, one of our B-26s had received a shot through an engine and knocked out the oil cooler. And I was assigned to take an oil cooler in a little L-5, a little fabric-covered cub. They were used mostly as observation planes, but I was to fly this up to Luxembourg. I had a fellow with me. Lieutenant Cones was with me, but I had charge of the mission on the way up. We stopped at Reims, got some fuel, and on the way to Luxembourg, ran into a headwind that we had not anticipated. And when I got very near Luxembourg, the gas gauge showed empty. So I landed in a little pasture somewhere outside of Luxembourg.
Now, you're making this sound very matter-of-fact.
Yeah, it was not too hard. You could land in a pasture. Anyway, there was an anti-aircraft battalion, our side, next to the field, and next to the pasture. We got 5 gallons of gas from them, put it in the plane, and frankly, we flipped a coin to see who was going to take it off. And whether I won or lost, I don't know. But I was sitting in the back seat. Don was in the front. And we started down the pasture and came to a sudden stop at the end because there was a little ditch there that we didn't clear. The plane stopped immediately. I got hit on the back of the head and neck with the oil cooler that was on the shelf behind me and knocked unconscious for a short period of time. First thing I knew was Don says, the plane's on fire, let's get out of here. So the undercarriage had been knocked out, so we were sitting on the ground. I set the oil cooler out, got out, and we stood off and watched it burn.
Well, and I want to take you back, just rewind a minute here. When you're talking about putting it down in the pasture, you said, yeah, no big deal. But when you're up in that L5 and you've got a headwind, were you basically standing still? Is that what it felt like?
Oh, no, it wasn't that bad. No, the only reason I say we had a headwind is because we didn't have enough fuel to make our destination.
Mm-hmm. And had you probably hadn't been in that situation before, right? I mean, you hadn't been in a lot of L5s, but...
No, and I had never flown an L5 before, frankly.
Well, there's that, too. But so when you run out of gas and you're up in the air, you start looking for some place you can put it down.
That's the first thing you do in any training.
Mm-hmm.
From the time you start flying training in an airplane, you learn where you're going to land if something goes wrong. Primary flying school all the way through. Where am I going to put it down if the engine stops? So you're automatically thinking of that all the time.
And this was all friendly territory?
Yes, it had been already taken.
That helps. But how long did it take you to see this clearing? Were you looking at forest and finally here's a clearing?
No,
or did you see it right
away? Most of it was open land around there.
So that helps. That makes you feel a little better.
It was
easy.
That was not a problem.
I don't know if it was easy. I don't know if I'm buying you on that, but I'll take your word for it. So then you get knocked unconscious by this oil cooler, which was what you came there to bring to the B-26.
We did complete it. That we got it out and took it on into them.
And then how'd you get out of there?
Somebody took us into town in a truck. And then how I got back, I frankly can't remember whether somebody took us in a 6x6 back to Paris. And then right after we got back to Paris, we transferred into Belgium. So I was in one of those back of a 6x6 for a long time. And it bothered my head and neck that I so much that then I went into a hospital in Charleroi, Belgium, for a while.
So this was no fun for you.
That wasn't fun.
It sounds like it could have been a lot worse.
Could have been, sure. Anytime.
You were actually unconscious and woke up to a to find out you're on the inside of a burning plane.
Right.
And I'm amazed by how matter-of-fact this discussion is for you. I guess you've told the story a few times, but I don't know what I would do if I woke up in the middle of a burning plane.
You get out. It's very simple.
And you completed your mission. You got that oil cooler
That's
to the
right.
B-26.
That's right.
When you think about the guys that you served with, what kind of characteristics did you appreciate in them? When you think back and you think about the kind of people that Americans were at that time, and servicemen and the pilots and crew members in the U.S. Army Air Corps, what did you most appreciate about them?
Everybody was dedicated in doing the job the best way they could. We had a job to do. We wanted to do it, finish it up, and come home. And everyone, the people at home, my oldest brother helped in the shipyards in the Bay Area building Victory ships. And the brother next older than I was in the Navy in the South Pacific. We just wanted to get the job done and come home.
You ever think back and reflect on those close calls you had and wonder, could that have really been me? And why did I survive when someone else maybe did not?
That's another subject we're not going to get into. I presented a little program at our church one day. Why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
And I just rather not get in it because we get very religious then, and I don't want to do that.
I'm not trying to stop you from that. We've got a couple minutes left.
You wonder why you're here. Why am I still here?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason?
Mm-hmm.
Does God have some reason for going through these things and getting here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think you do know. And that's what I get from you, that you feel like God had a plan for you.
That's exactly right.
And it's kind of hard to argue with that when you look back at all the facts. Is there one thing, Bob, that you personally are most proud to have taken part in a particular mission or grander scheme of things kind of idea in the war in Europe that you look back on and that just really makes you feel good to have had a hand in it?
One thing that sticks in my mind is when we went into Munich in Army of Occupation, some of the guys from our group went to Dachau, mm-hmm. and they saw what had happened there,
mm.
and they told about it, and frankly, I'm glad that I didn't go, but that's one of the reasons that we were there, and that's one of the reasons that we were successful is because we were dedicated in doing the job, finishing that thing up, and the things that were going on over there were just things that you don't want to talk about.
No, but it's so important that truth is not lost. Holocaust Remembrance Day is coming up on May the 5th this year. It's time for another break right now. We've heard from two men who will be enjoying a free flight to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial next week. Maybe you're one of those who donated to make it all possible. But also on that honor flight will be five brothers. And we'll hear from the oldest of that quintet when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Getting to know 3 of the men scheduled to visit the National World War II Memorial this week, flying free of charge with Central Valley Honor Flight out of Fresno, California. This is something that's happening all over the country. Monday night at 8:30, you can welcome heroes home in Bakersfield at the airport there. In Fresno, Wednesday night, April 27th at Fresno Yosemite International Airport. The Freeze family should have a pretty large contingent there to welcome home Central Valley Honor Flight, because there are 5 Freeze brothers going on the same flight. Harry, Bobby, John, Richard, and Don Freeze all served our country, and they're all scheduled to make this journey of a lifetime together. Don is the oldest at 91. He's a recipient of the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart, serving with the 1st Infantry Division. And we'll find out now how he ended up in the Battle of the Bulge.
We had pulled back to Belgium to get new reinforcements and get them trained to understand a little bit about what was going to happen to them in the front lines. I don't know, first notice we got, we had been there about a week or so when we heard about the Battle of the Bulge and the Germans. You could see them flying over and in some cases dropping paratroopers not far from us. So we actually just started walking toward where the Germans were at. Oh, it just got pretty intensive.
And, of course, the Ardennes forest, heavily forested area and well-fortified, and the weather is infamous in this time of world history, the worst winter they had ever seen. And I'm sure growing up in Fresno probably hadn't prepared you for the cold conditions you faced there.
To begin with, it was quite rainy and muddy and things that we weren't used to here in Fresno, but the cold weather settled in, and that, of course, got things even worse, because it got cold enough so if you tried to dig a hole, unless you had dynamite or something to blast with, or TNT, it was just almost impossible to dig holes, but until you got through at least a foot and a half or so of the ground. We tried to always dig in the 60-millimeter mortars prior to our foxholes or in the woods. We tried to get sleeping holes and stuff so you could put a top on. We put logs over the top to keep from getting clobbered when the artillery came in. And then, of course, it got real cold. And when the Battle of the Bulge started, it was real cold weather. And we wanted to be a mortar squad, but for a long time we were looking for German soldiers in the woods. And everybody became an infantryman, at least for about a week, until we got settled and knew what was going on.
So you had to rely on a rifle for self-defense and self-preservation with, you know, enemy soldiers wandering through the woods. And I guess you had developed a pretty sharp shooting eye. I've seen some of your sharpshooting medals on the wall there, too. Did you feel pretty comfortable and confident with that rifle on your shoulder?
Oh, I was confident about the rifle. I wasn't confident about what was going to happen, because we couldn't use the mortars very well. We were in a heavy, heavy woods where they planted trees in Germany. Every year they plant trees to grow up and use for fence posts and then lumber. So all we could think about was getting under cover and going forward when they said forward.
I can't imagine it was very easy to sleep at night for multiple reasons. First, you're probably shivering to death, and second, you don't know what's out there. Did you find any way to kind of help you cope with the ever-present danger of an enemy and Mother Nature with the fierce weather?
Oh, you get used to know what's going on, and about half the men would stay up at night no matter where we were stationed, and the other half would try to sleep. And believe it or not, you can sleep. Under very, very bad conditions, you can sleep real well after a while.
When you see that happen, and you described how the very first thing you had to do in Europe in World War II was pull a dead officer out of a tree, when you see the guys that you know go down, you know that they're not coming back, doesn't it make you wonder, am I next? When's my number going to get called? You know, when is my time going to be up? Is that something that you couldn't avoid thinking about?
Well, you couldn't avoid thinking about it because you look at some of the men that had been with the outfit, with the company for years, and maybe you only got wounded slightly once or twice, and then all of a sudden he catches it, an artillery round or machine gun or something, and he's dead. So you wonder, when is my turn?
Now you have the Purple Heart, and that tells me that you were eventually hit. What were the circumstances of that, and what can you tell us?
Well, we were in the attack situation and going again through the woods. Normally, the riflemen take care of anything out in front, but in this case, we were trying to clear out of small woods that the tanks, Patton and them, had gone through, and they left little pockets that we tried to clean out as infantrymen. One of the situations developed where they had bypassed a machine gun. I guess it had a lot of ammunition and were quite accurate, and they opened fire on our mortar section as we were going through, and of course, first thing you do is hit the ground if you can, and I hit the ground and looked for anything that was low, and I ended up in a slit trench, straddle trench, or whatever you want to call it. But even though it was real messy, it did save my life because only part of my rear end was showing, and I got nicked on it. And then shortly thereafter, when shrapnel came in, I got wounded on the wrist, and nothing serious.
Now, I want to give our listeners the full picture of this here. When you talk about a slit trench, somebody might change the second letter and slit for that trench, and you know, there are a lot of different pictures we could paint of that, but maybe understanding what those trenches are normally used for would give our listeners an idea what you're dealing with.
It's a toilet. And it was full.
You were up to your eyeballs in stuff that didn't smell too good, and it probably stayed that way for a while?
Right. I was in there for 2-3 minutes before I could get out, before they got the machine gunner.
Did you need immediate medical attention, or would no one want to come very near you at that point?
Oh, at that time, there was no medical attention needed. I mean, our first aid man just bandaged me up, and we had no problem. It was shortly after that, though, that I got a slight case of frostbite, so they sent me back to the hospital to recover from that or be treated for that. And when I got there, they found out I had yellow jaundice, is what we used to call it. Now they call it hepatitis, but the yellow eyes and all that stuff. So I was about 2 weeks in the hospital in France, and that was wonderful. Laying on just a little canvas cot was heaven. But they got it cured and everything, and told me about one day, they told me I was going into the replacement center and be sent back up to the front. And of course, I wanted my outfit, so I went AWOL and headed for the front and had no trouble at all. Everybody, even though they knew I was AWOL, I was going in the right direction, so I finally got back to my outfit and resumed the battle.
Now, you say that all so matter-of-factly, but I'm thinking of myself in your shoes, and your whole life as a member of the military is based on following orders and not disobeying them. What made you decide that in this case you weren't going to listen to them and you're going to do your own thing?
Just the fact that I wanted to be back among people I knew, well, that I soldiered with, and I was sure they'd welcome me back, so I went that way.
And clearly you made it.
Yes.
Well, when you look back at the incident that earned you the Purple Heart, you're wounded on your rear, on your hand, you dealt with the contents of the slit trench, ended up with the jaundice and were in the hospital, the amount of time that took you out of combat. There's another medal that hangs near that Purple Heart, the combat infantry badge on his wall. It's the Bronze Star. And Don, one thing I've realized over the years in interviewing so many veterans is a lot of time it's hard to get them to talk about their decorations. I find some guys who won't even tell me about the prestigious medals they have until after I'm done interviewing them. But I've seen the Bronze Star. I know it's there. And I know you don't like to draw attention to yourself, but if you can, share with me the events that led to you being awarded that Bronze Star and how you experienced it.
Well, it occurred during one one of our attack phases. We were moving up through the woods, and all of a sudden we got clobbered by tanks or tank fire. It was pretty devastating because we were caught off guard. Quite a few people went down, and there was one small group that was being surrounded by the German infantry that was counterattacking. There was no way to use the mortars at that time, and so I helped by going forward and helping to lay down a little bit of rifle fire, trying to relieve the men that were up there, and we finally got the Germans to retreat, and they thought it was, actually it was the only thing I could do, but they thought it was pretty good, so they gave me a medal.
Well, and it sounds like, as I'm trying to picture this in my head, listening to you describe it, so the American soldiers were surrounded by the Germans. They're in jeopardy of being killed or captured if no one did anything.
I guess that's the way you'd put it. We just, all we did was help move the Germans back so it would relieve our infantry people that were being surrounded, and we got them out. That's about it.
You hear that humility? It's a pretty familiar sound if you listen to this program on a regular basis, because it is one of the defining characteristics of our greatest generation. All the more reason the mission of Honor Flight is so important. Honorflight.org is the website. I encourage you to become a part of it wherever you're listening to the show today. And again, if you're in my neck of the woods, I'll see you at the Fresno Airport Wednesday evening, 5:30, to welcome home a whole plane load of hometown heroes. That's the program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.